Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and in particular, thank you to David Byers and Grant Anderson for those introductory remarks. As you all here know better than I, CEDA's stated purpose is to promote Australia's economic development in a sustainable and socially balanced way. This objective is particularly germane to the topic of today's discussion, broadly, climate change and our response to it. Achieving sustainable economic, social and environmental outcomes is at the heart of the government's climate change framework, with its three pillars of reducing Australia's greenhouse gas emissions, adapting to climate change we cannot avoid, and helping to shape a global solution. This three-pillar framework accepts that climate change is occurring and that we need to both manage the transition to a low-carbon future and adapt to a changing world. It is an approach consistent with the findings of economic modelling that suggests that modest, near-term mitigation enhances global welfare. It recognises that decisions are being made daily that have the potential to increase Australia's exposure to climate conditions in the future in ways that are substantially different to what we've experienced historically. With the release of the Green Paper on the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme, the government has indicated key elements of its thinking on how best to manage Australia's own emissions as we manage the transition to a low-carbon economy. The scheme proposes the development of a financial market, an emissions trading scheme, designed to deliver an environmental outcome. The ultimate objective is not, however, the creation of a trading scheme. That is simply a tool. The ultimate objective is to help the world avoid dangerous climate change. The Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme aims to do this by demonstrating that it is possible to deliver significant emissions reductions while ensuring continued prosperity. In the process, it will position Australia well to reap the many opportunities that will flow from a move to a low-carbon world. Placing a price on greenhouse gas emissions, carbon pollution, is key to ensuring that strong economic growth can be maintained. The creation of a robust carbon market will provide information on the carbon price now and into the future. It will provide a powerful incentive for consumers and business to switch to lower carbon products and production techniques, to change investment patterns, and to encourage greater efforts in new and innovative areas of research and development. Using a market-based approach to introduce this price will also make it easier for business to plan for the future. Providing business with the tools to manage carbon risk will also ensure the policy response can be sustained into the decades ahead. Social balance is also an important consideration in the Green Paper. If a policy is to be sustained over time, government must take account of the implications for the community, particularly the impacts on the most vulnerable and adversely affected members of our society. The Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme is the most significant economic structural reform since the 1980s. It is not surprising, then, that it is a subject of debate, both in terms of its design and in terms of its impact on the economy. The release of the Green Paper has, however, also provided another opportunity for those who dispute the existence of climate change. Given all this, I thought it would be useful today to outline why climate change is a significant issue for Australia, why it makes sense for Australia to move now to respond, and why the development of a well-designed emissions trading scheme is the most effective way for us to move forward. Last month, Professor Garnaut released a compelling draft report of his climate change review. If there is one message from Professor Garnaut's report, it is that failure on climate change is not an option. As one of the hottest and driest continents on Earth, Australia's economy and environment is likely to be one of the hardest and fastest hit by climate change. Indeed, more broadly, parts of our social fabric, such as the viability of farming communities in the Murray-Darling Basin, are directly threatened by unmitigated climate change. The IPCC Fourth Assessment Report, released last year, presents evidence of observed changes in climate patterns. Increased air and ocean temperatures, melting of snow and ice, and sea level rise, that taken together provide evidence that climate change has begun to happen. The IPCC also concludes that it is very likely that greenhouse gas increases related to human activity have caused most of the rise in global mean temperatures since the mid-20th century. More recent data and research suggests that the rate and magnitude of climate change during this century may occur at the upper end of the range estimated by the IPCC. Not only are emissions growing faster than had been anticipated, the science suggests the climate response is also accelerating. The climate system is complex. We have to accept that our understanding of the scale, timing, and likelihood of specific impacts will lack precision into the future. But the balance of probability points to climate change as a fact. We are faced with a global risk management problem, and we should respond accordingly. Yet notwithstanding the weight of evidence, commentary continues about whether global warming is actually occurring or will present a real risk. The pattern of recent global temperatures measured against those in the year 1998 in particular has led to claims that global warming is a thing of the past. The point I just highlighted, I'm sorry that everybody won't be able to see it, is actually 1998. And indeed, it was a very hot year. This was in part due to the major El Niño event, which elevated global temperatures. The nature of the climate system is such that there are considerable fluctuations in global average temperatures from year to year and decade to decade. However, the long-term record of temperatures shows a clear underlying rise. So contrary to what people claim, that since 1998 temperatures have been falling, so basically they've taken one point, 1998, and said, well, the years since haven't been above it, and this is only looking at the bottom set of data, and they're concluding that global warming is not true. Well, the bottom set of data here is 150 years of combined land and ocean temperatures compiled by the Hadley Centre in the UK. They show the warmest 10 years have all been since 1995. The other two data sets that are shown here are independent. They've been scaled up by half a degree and by 1 degree to make them understandable. But they show exactly the same pattern, even when they show that 1998 may not actually be the hottest year on record. But changes in Australia's climate are also readily observable. The annual average temperature in Australia has increased by around 0.9 of a degree since 1910. Since 1950, average annual temperatures have recorded increases in almost all parts of Australia, with higher increases in Central Australia and parts of Queensland and Northern Territory. So what this chart's showing you is that the cumulative change in the average temperature over the period since 1950. These increases in temperature have combined with reductions in rainfall in many parts of the country to result in significant reductions in flow into catchments supplying water to our major capitals. Information on dam inflows into Perth is particularly striking. That's what this chart shows. Annual dam inflows between 1976 and 2000 were roughly half of what they were between 1911 and 1975. Even more striking is that they halved again between 2001 and 2007. And perhaps even more chilling is the fact that not since 1975 have inflows, even in good years, reached the previous average. Climate change is likely to negatively affect Australians in a variety of ways, but particularly as a result of increasing severity and frequency of extreme weather events. The impacts of unmitigated climate change on Australia will include significant risks within a few decades to coastal buildings from storm events and sea level rise. Recent analysis by Geoscience Australia indicates that Australia-wide, building assets in excess of $33 trillion are located within 200 metres of the present high water mark. Continuing work will evaluate how much of that building stock and our infrastructure may be prone to future sea inundation. Inundation of areas such as St Kilda in Melbourne, which is shown here, and the Gold Coast, as a result of higher sea levels and severe storm events, will impose significant costs on the economy. And again, just to describe this, for those of you who know Melbourne, that up the top, right in the up in the that is Albert Park Lake. So basically, you're turning the rest of St Kilda into a lake on quite reasonable climate change prospects. Now, being in Sydney, people may not be concerned about that, but when I make this point in Melbourne, it worries a lot of people. While the weight of scientific evidence makes a compelling case that climate change is real, the precautionary principle suggests that even someone who is agnostic on the issue should rationally wish to take action now. For the agnostic, action today can be thought of as analogous to taking out insurance or hedging one's position. It involves incurring a cost now with the prospect, though for the agnostic, not the certainty, of gaining in the future. The wider the range of possible future outcomes, what I referred to earlier as the lack of precision about specific events, the wider the range of options over which it is rational to hedge, and hence the greater the benefits of near-term mitigation. Except for the climate change deniers, who have misappropriated the term sceptic, I think we would all agree that avoiding dangerous climate change is a global challenge requiring a multilateral solution. In the absence of global action, the mitigation efforts of Australia alone will provide little, if any, benefit. So why then should Australia be amongst the countries that takes early action to drive global abatement? Why shouldn't we wait for others to do the heavy lifting? First, given our natural environment and importantly our industrial structure, Australia is unique amongst the developed economies in its vulnerability both to the impacts of climate change and importantly to what other countries might adopt as policy responses. This vulnerability means that it is in our national interest to pursue both an effective global solution and to begin now the necessary domestic transformation, both through reducing our own emissions and beginning to adapt to the climate change that we are likely to confront into the future. Second, it's incorrect to believe that Australia is at the head of the pack. Some 27 countries in Europe, both European Union and non-European Union, have already moved to adopt emissions trading. The New Zealand trading scheme commenced on 1 January this year, and Japan is discussing the introduction of a full-scale domestic scheme in 2010 or 2011, following earlier trials of voluntary schemes. The Canadian federal government, in addition to some 26 US states and Canadian provinces, are working to introduce emissions trading. Both the Democratic and Republican US presidential candidates have committed themselves to introducing a cap and trade scheme. It strikes me that as a small open economy, we want to be ready when that dam breaks. Australia has a strong interest in accelerating global action, both to reduce the risks of adverse climate change impacts and to reduce the cost of our own mitigation efforts. Our influence in international climate change negotiations is likely to be affected by what we do at home. Importantly, the introduction of effective, market-based carbon reduction policy in Australia provides the opportunity to demonstrate to other countries the success of policy approaches that would enhance Australia's economic welfare were they to be adopted widely. A sustainable global solution will require action by all major emitters, developed and developing, and Australia is committed to an international framework in which advanced economies adopt binding economy-wide emissions reduction targets with efforts comparable to our own, and when major developing countries make binding comments on mitigation actions. But this is one of the facts that we have to confront. Developed countries are responsible for the bulk of the atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gases. So we have to have developing countries in, but developed countries, frankly, face a dilemma. When we sit down to negotiate, we know that people on the other side of the table are looking at us and saying, it's your problem, sunshine. When are you going to start to address it? Now, it's inevitable that global agreement will require stronger action, therefore, by the developed nations. In part, this is because of the relatively high levels of per capita emissions in developed compared to developing economies. That is, we've developed on the back of the carbon economy. But even amongst developed countries, and I'm sorry if this chart isn't that clear, even amongst developed countries, Australia's per capita emissions are at the top end. Early action by developed countries also recognises that by the fact that we have higher income levels relative to developing economies means that we have more resources to implement emissions reductions policies. Any viable global solution must, though, recognise the legitimate aspirations of developing countries to continue to raise their living standards towards our own. Notwithstanding the rapid growth in China and to a lesser extent India, this chart highlights the actual gap in living standards per head between the countries that are major emitters. So it's in Australia's interest to shape the emerging global market. We have to be realistic about our ability to influence the big decisions, such as emissions reduction targets. But as a middle power, we can play a powerfully influential role in designing the mechanics of the international system. But you'll only get a seat at this table if you're actively engaged in designing and operating these mechanisms at home. Even if we accept that there is a need to treat climate change as a risk management issue and that the developed economies need to act first, why should Australia, therefore, adopt a carbon pollution reduction scheme? Why not do something else? In particular, what of the claims that the introduction of the scheme will be excessively costly and threaten our economy? First, it is not the introduction of the scheme that imposes a cost on the economy. Climate change is already imposing costs, and these will only increase over time. So there are real and rising costs to inaction. These costs also include the impact on investment certainty. It is true, though, that taking action to restrain our emissions to help avoid these costs will introduce another set of costs. But it's the decision to cap emissions that is important. It's the decision to cap emissions that imposes the cost, not the existence of an emissions trading scheme. And indeed, the decision of the previous government to meet Australia's Kyoto target resulted in the imposition of costs on the economy over the last decade. It was the realisation that the abatement achieved to date could not be repeated going forward using the existing policies unless we incurred a very, very significant cost that led the Howard government to support the introduction of emissions trading. The current government's judgment is that the costs of inaction exceed the costs of action, and importantly, that the use of emissions trading allows us to ensure that the costs of action are minimised. Second, it's important to keep in mind the distinction between the trajectory or pathways for emissions reduction and the design of the trading scheme. As Minister Wong has noted, this is analogous to the distinction between designing and building the car and the decision about how fast to drive it. Irrespective of the speed we ultimately drive at, we want a robust, effective and credible vehicle if we are to reach the destination in comfort and safety. Not surprisingly then, I am unconvinced by claims that we should not make decisions on the design without having already determined the trajectory. I want a design that is robust and credible and delivers the outcomes that we need, irrespective of the pace at which we start to move towards it. On the issue of the pace, the government has committed to selecting an emissions trajectory by the end of this year that is achievable and economically responsible. It will be calibrated to the global effort. It will reflect the analysis provided by the Treasury on the relative costs of alternative trajectories, and it will be subject to consultation before final decisions are made. Importantly, though, the cost of restraining emissions will be heavily influenced by the dynamism and flexibility of the economy. Governments in Australia have learned, often painfully, that it is better to manage transition than to attempt to hold back the forces of change. A continuing focus on fostering a flexible, dynamic economy and resisting the siren call of attempting to pick sectoral or technological winners will be critical to ensuring the orderly transformation of Australia to a low-carbon economy capable of sustained growth in employment and living standards. Let me turn now to the design features that make for an effective and efficient trading scheme. First and foremost, broad coverage is important. The broader the coverage, the lower the cost of achieving any given reduction in emissions. Second, the scheme must be designed to link effectively with international markets. This helps cap the cost of abatement to Australian firms. It helps create, over time, the true network of global responses that we need. Third, a good scheme needs to recognise the cost of restraining emissions in the absence of that global agreement, and therefore attempt to reduce carbon leakage, that is, the risk of emissions-intensive trade-exposed activities moving offshore without any impact on global abatement. But it's not enough to stop here. It's not enough to say we have to be conscious of carbon leakage. A good scheme has to recognise that the more support that is given to such activities, the greater is the share of the costs that are therefore shifted to the rest of the economy, to non-assisted trade-exposed firms, to trade-exposed businesses, and to households. There's no easy way of resolving this tension. We should be honest about it. We should be open about it. The government recognises that industries will wish to focus the debate on the potential for lost investment within their sector. But the government, recognising that that's what industries will do to argue their case for additional support, has to balance that against similar claims from other sectors. The more support provided for any one industry or sector, the greater the impact on investment and employment in other non-assisted sectors is an immutable problem that we face in this area. Moreover, it's unrealistic to believe that these tensions can be resolved by increasing the national cap for new investments in the emissions-intensive trade-exposed sector. As discussed above, we're committed to an international framework that involves binding national targets or commitments for all major emitters. Our emissions-intensive trade-exposed sectors, more than any other, will benefit from success in achieving an effective global emissions reduction framework. Arguing that our national emissions cap should have a get-out clause in the way proposed is unlikely to assist us in reaching that goal. Fourth, the market in which the carbon pollution permits are traded should be designed to be as well-functioning as possible. The characteristics of the permit need to be clearly defined, the trading mechanisms transparent, and transactions costs kept to a minimum to maximise the efficiency of the scheme. Fifth, governance arrangements need to be clearly defined, as these will affect the credibility and ultimately the ongoing success of the scheme. Governance arrangements are always important, but I think they're particularly so when you're trying to establish a policy in which market-based instruments are used to influence long-term investments. Finally, a well-designed scheme is one that is robust to changes in scheme objectives over time. For the scheme to provide an effective ongoing mechanism for market participants to manage their climate change risks, it needs to be flexible enough to accommodate changes in targets and trajectories as new information emerges. Together, these features, the nuts and bolts of the emissions trading scheme, will determine the integrity of this scheme and how effectively and smoothly it works to reduce emissions. It's up to others to judge whether the preferred positions laid out in the Green Paper achieve this, but they are at least the objectives that we've been trying to meet. But let me just make a couple of observations on the Green Paper as I sum up. It is a genuine options paper. We have tried to identify the key issues for decision, to identify competing policy objectives, to carefully examine the alternative options, and to identify the government's current preferred position on each of a very large number of issues. Preferred positions are provided so the community has a clear idea of where we're starting from and so that we can begin to have the substantive discussion that we need. As Grant said, it is the beginning, not the end. These preferred positions reflect the current information available to us and have been informed by the previous work. And Grant mentioned that, the National Emissions Trading Scheme, the Task Group on Emissions Trading, GANO Review, the work that's been done here and elsewhere. But it also reflects extensive consultations my department's been having over the last year with industry, community groups and other stakeholders. Having said that, we are acutely aware that you will have better access in some areas to information than we have. Parts of the business community will be in a better position to assess how well aspects of the proposed policy would work in practice. You may also be able to bring to our attention things that we haven't been aware of or which we haven't given full consideration to in the Green Paper. We are after feedback. This is not a stalking horse. This is a genuine options paper. We want ideas. We want data. We want discussion. But the one thing I'd say is that we welcome all ideas about alternative ways in which the identified objectives of the scheme can be met. It's the objectives that I think are the bit that is set in stone. In conclusion, serious reforms are always confronting. Typically, they involve changes to the settled way of doing things, they redistribute risk, and unfortunately, they force a reassessment of economic value. The challenge for our generation is to develop effective strategies to address climate change, to manage the transition to a low-carbon future. We will be judged by future generations on our success. I look forward to continuing the productive engagement with CEDA and with many of you individually that we've had today as we try and work our way through to develop Australia's response to this challenge. Thank you.